Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Impact Factor. I am your host, Katie Van Aken, and we come back this week after a short break with an interview I did with another Haverford grad who is doing her PhD in cognitive neuroscience. And so, I give you my conversation with Hannah Morgan. Let's jump in. So, Hannah, it has been so long, and I'm so excited to talk to you and hear what you're up to. So, let's start. Let's just take it back. So what, we were in college together 10 years ago for a year, I guess we overlapped, but you had declared a major, or what was your sort of direction at that point?
Yeah. So direction freshman year or?
Yeah. Or whenever. When was your direction clear to you? Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So at least before college, one of my childhood heroes was Dr. Jane Goodall. So when I was really young, I was really committed to being a scientist, and I didn't quite know what that was. When I was little, I was like, oh, I'm going to go study lemurs in Madagascar, kind of like Jane Goodall. So that was kind of
nice.
That was kind of my plan. So when I got to Haverford, I was exploring biology a little bit, some anthropology. But then I kind of realized maybe sophomore year that psychology was actually more interesting to me. So like how humans are behaving. And so that's where I kind of got into psychology. I took a really great psychology 101 course just kind of on a whim. And I really liked it. And I saw my previous interests with primates overlapping a bit with humans. And so like how they behave. And I was like, okay, this makes sense. And that's where I started diving into psychology. You must have missed this at Haverford, but I think my junior year, they had just opened up a minor in neuroscience.
Yes.
So they were working on that.
Yeah.
So unfortunately it wasn't a major at the time. I think if it was, that's probably what I would have ended up doing was probably major in neuroscience. But so I ended up doing a major in psychology, minor in neuroscience, which was super new at the time. And I think Haverford now has a major in neuroscience. But yeah, I started down that path. I ended up doing my senior thesis with EEG and human behavior with Dr. Rebecca Compton. And that's what really got me excited about where I am now. And over the summers too, I was, I'm from Connecticut. So I got to work at Yale over the summers doing also human behavior research at the Yale Child Study Center. So working with EEG and kids and, you know, how they think. So yeah, it's kind of what brought me here to UNC doing my PhD in cognitive psychology.
Very cool. Can I ask you what specifically like human behavior you were after? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that. I don't know if it was my senior year or my junior year, but I participated in a study at Haverford where they hooked my head up to all the things. And then they asked me how long I thought it would take me to like sort all of these boring encyclopedia books in order. And then they had me do it. And it was all about like time estimation and stuff like that. So I don't know.
Yeah. That's not too far off from what I was doing at the time. Probably it was probably an EEG. Were there like a lot of electrodes on your head?
Yeah. And they had to put the gel on your head too. Yep.
Yep. Takes forever to get out. Yep. that's what I do now. And that's what I have been doing for the past 10 years. But yeah, so that's, that was my senior thesis, was something fairly similar, using EEG with, some like cognitive training. But when I was in college, I didn't exactly know what specific cognitive mechanism I was interested in. So I was just kind of exploring a lot of stuff with mostly different clinical disorders. So that's kind of my background. So at Yale, I did some work with kids who have aggressive behaviors specifically, and we did again EEG with them. And then at Haverford, something like fairly similar. And then when I graduated from Haverford, I went to UC Davis to work. We'll get more into that later probably, but that was also with kids who have a clinical disorder. So at the time, I was kind of interested in more what at the time was called abnormal psychology. And so, like, what is going on specifically with kids that might be different developmentally? So that's more what I was interested in. But at least now I'm more interested in kind of typical attention. And I'm sure we'll also get into that more, but for now I'm really interested in attention and how we get distracted, and that's kind of
Oh,
where my
cool.
journey has led me. If
Okay,
that makes
cool. Well,
sense.
I can't wait to ask you about that because that seems very interesting. So, okay, cool. So at Haverford, you're graduating. At that point, had you thought about getting a PhD? Or yeah, what was your sort of thought process there?
I was always interested in getting a PhD. I think when I was freshman, sophomore, I just didn't really know what that meant, but I knew I was going to do more school. And at least at Haverford too, the one thing I really love about Haverford is they train you to be going to more school.
A good learner, right?
I know, like, I knew I was really lucky to have a lot of support from my professors and friends who were going to school, like for more school. So I knew that PhD or master's was in my future, and I knew that because I did want to stay in academia, and I do still want to stay in academia. So that was the most logistical, like, next step for me, like to have my own lab at a bigger school, kind of do similar things to what professors at Haverford were doing, at least research-wise. So it at least made sense. I just didn't fully know what that meant, which is why I decided to work first before getting a PhD.
Which I've gotten the sense, and I, full disclosure, I haven't interviewed a ton of people in psychology, but I get the sense that a lot of people do work either in a lab or mostly in a lab before going back to school for their PhD. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, it's becoming more and more common.
Yeah.
It's getting more expensive too. So I think some people are like, I would like to save up money just practically, which is
Yeah.
a really great idea. And I know for a lot of programs, it's just getting so competitive, and that's
Yeah.
probably the same across the board. And unfortunately, a lot of people that are reviewing applications kind of look for the work experience now, which stinks. And I know that applies to medical school and a lot of other disciplines as well. So it's just getting tough, but
Yeah.
it's also just good to, at least for me, solidify that I really did like want to spend 6 to 7 years like in a PhD. I was like, okay, this is at least going to confirm that this is what I want
Yeah.
to do.
And also, I feel like there's a benefit in sort of seeing what's out there. And also, like, obviously, your kind of interests have shifted. And so, you know, we're only exposed to so much in undergrad and being out there at a bigger university or a bigger lab and learning how to read papers and, you know, go to conferences, even like that really lets you hone what your interest is, which I think is a cool thing.
Totally. And it, at least for me, it lets you know what you don't like as much
Yes,
too. Like within
yes.
your field, I think that's a nice, I think if I had just gone straight from Haverford to a PhD, like I probably would have ended up doing something I didn't love quite as much. But I'm really glad I ended up working and being like, okay, there's a certain part of the science that I don't like. And
Yeah.
so now when I choose a place to go, I knew that going into it. But
So tell me more about your UC Davis, you said, right? And that was you were like a lab, like a research fellow or something, assistant.
So I was a research assistant. I think at the UCs or the University of California system. They call it junior specialist, but
Oh,
it is a research
fancy.
assistant. I know. I felt very fancy. But it was a great, really great experience. I was working at the UC Davis Mind Institute, which specifically focuses on childhood developmental disorders. So my lab specifically was looking at kids who have 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, which is a very rare microdeletion, and it can cause a lot of cognitive difficulties in the kids who have it. So my lab specifically was looking at that, like the cognitive differences in those kiddos. And something that was the project I was on specifically is a lot of the kids that do have 22q develop schizophrenia and other psych disorders of psychosis later in life. So we were trying to figure out, and it was a lot higher than the population that doesn't have 22q. So my study was doing a big longitudinal study on these kids to see what was going on before they were diagnosed with any sort of psychosis and after, to see any like brain behavior changes, if we could learn more, and to see if we can learn more about psychosis and like schizophrenia. That's what I was doing.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I assume you were doing EEG work as well. So is that sort of monitoring brain activity while the kids were doing certain tasks?
Yeah, you got it. Yep. So yeah, we were doing EEG with those kids. We were doing fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging with them as well. We were doing blood draws, cortisol
Oh, so everything.
draws, yeah, IQ tests, like all these cognitive batteries. It was 2 full days of research for one kid. So it was a really big study. It was a lot. It was great. Like a lot of great experiences, made me very competitive for the
Yeah, I'm sure.
PhD like applications. But it was a really big project, and they're doing such great work there
Yeah.
too. So that was really lovely to see.
Longitudinal studies are hard too because they take so long, right? But it sounds like you got a lot of experience analyzing all kinds of data.
Yeah, at least collecting data. Since I was a research assistant, we didn't do as much analyzing as you would like if you were a grad student or a postdoc,
Sure.
but I got a lot of great experience collecting the data, at least like looking at the data, doing some analyses with it as well. Yeah, it was a really great experience before doing a PhD, for sure.
How did you feel about the sort of component of your research that was the working with humans to do those tests, like the clinical part of it, I guess.
Yeah. So if you noticed, I'm no longer doing clinical work. At least for me, like I loved working with the kids that were in my study. The parents were incredible. I love working with people. I just had a hard time. I was taking a lot of stuff home with me. Because we do some clinical interviews with them, and I just found myself being like really worried about the kids, like when I got home, or I'm just like, oh, so that's what drew me away from clinical psychology specifically. I was like, okay, if you can't handle this in this setting, like maybe you're not gonna be a great therapist, or maybe this work isn't totally for you. But I really fell in love with the cognitive mechanism questions that we were looking at. So like, how are they attending to certain things, like how are they getting distracted, how are like emotionally, like what emotional faces are they looking at? So I found myself really liking that part of the research, which is why I shifted to cognitive psychology for a PhD. So I'm not doing any sort of clinical work really right now. But I think eventually, like, so after my PhD, I am planning to do a postdoc. So I'm kind of hoping that I can get back into the clinical world a little bit, but be that like brain person on the study, if that makes sense. So I'm coming in being like, oh, what are the cognitive mechanisms that you're interested in? What can I help you with to a clinician? And then I would love to collaborate to like answer those questions.
So
Kind of what I'm thinking.
like the clinical side would be like data collection almost, and like working, well, I guess you could help with that too, but you would be the expert when it comes to like what's going on in the brain of this patient. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be, I think that'd be really cool, but I'm still
Who
not quite
knows? Yeah.
there yet. I still have some time to figure it out, but
That's okay. You are allowed. Side note, I love that you sort of thought about what kind of ideal role you would have in the field, which is, I think, a good exercise for people too, because it's so easy to be like, oh, I'm going to be a professor, or like, oh, I'm going to work in industry. But like, what does that look like, you know?
right, which is another great thing about being able, like working at UC Davis after college. I got to see the project I was on at UC Davis was super collaborative. So we did have some more cognitive folks like coming in to talk to us like about the project. And I thought that was just so cool. And really the dream in science is just to be sitting at a table where everyone has their own expertise, because you can't be an expert in everything.
Oh my God, I
Like that's
love
just
that.
not possible. It's something I've learned. So you do need to rely on collaboration and science and in those things. But like that's the dream, to have like all these experts at one table and really
Yeah.
figuring out big questions.
We had a visitor, sorry, tangent, a visitor who gave a talk at Drexel, and I honestly can't remember what he talked about, what his research was about, but all I took from his talk was that he only hires PhD students who have undergraduate majors that are not his field. So he's basically putting together this team of diversely educated students who are smart and can learn, and having them solve problems. And I was like, what a cool environment to be in.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Yeah. So anyway, when you have your lab one day, consider that.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so you are now applying for programs, or after,
Not
no,
yet.
sorry, in your history
Oh, my history. Sure, yeah.
after UC Davis, you're now applying to programs. For your types of programs, was it, were you deciding between schools? Were there individual labs that you wanted to work with? Were there professors that you developed like relationships with ahead of the application? You know what I'm trying to get at?
Sure, yeah. Just to back up a little bit, I actually applied for the first time. So I've applied twice, just for a spoiler alert, but the first time
Oh.
I applied, it did not go very well. So I only got one interview.
Oh.
And I didn't get in. And I was like, what the heck is going on? Like everyone's been telling me, like a really strong applicant, like what the heck is going on? So the next time I applied, I actually joined a group at UC Davis that led by some wonderful like mentors, like PhDs that were really committed to getting people into grad school. And so they would meet with us almost every week and look at our cover letters and talk about like what programs would fit with what you're interested in. So the second time around, I was really more on top of it and trying to think more deeply about like what programs would actually fit with me. And the mistake I made the first time was I think I just like looked at a top 10 list of psychology and neuroscience programs. I was like, okay, I'm just gonna apply there. And like I didn't apply to people that were actually doing what I wanted to do. And so that's a
Yeah.
big thing when you're applying, right? You should probably apply to the person that's doing, or the lab that's doing stuff that you want to do. And I think that was really clear my first time applying. They were probably looking at my application being like, what the heck is this
Yeah.
doesn't align at all. And so the second time I applied, I was, working more on my cover letter separately and like doing more. But I think the biggest thing was I started emailing professors individually probably like 7 to 8 months ahead of time before the application, which is a big thing in my field. I'm not sure about your field. And sorry, just to take a step back too, for psychology and neuroscience, Usually, and at least psychology, usually you're applying to one person or one lab. So, I would email that person really early that I was interested in, and just, I had my standard email, but I was just like, "Hello, I'm Hannah Morgan. Just say a little bit about you. Are you taking students? If so, can I talk with you?"
Yeah.
And
Are
so
you taking
that,
students? That's a good part, right?
yeah.
Because if they're like, "No, I don't have any funding," you're like, "Okay, well."
Yeah, right. And they usually have that on their website just as a pro tip, or at least on the like somewhere on the graduate school page. But I would always just ask just in case. And that way too, they knew my name, they knew what I was about. Sometimes I would talk with them like over, Zoom or whatnot. But yeah, that was huge. And then yeah, I think that was the biggest change, honestly. Like, I changed my cover letter a bit. And then I actually ended up getting 10 interviews and getting into 8 schools that time. So it was a big change.
Oh, big change. Yeah. Return
Yeah.
on investment there.
Yeah. Yeah. I applied to more schools too, which helped. But yeah, I was really fortunate to have more schools to choose from when I was making the decision. So I had narrowed it down to UC Davis, UNC, UVA, and University of Utah, because they were all the four people I was thinking about working with there were just like really incredible researchers at the end of the
Yeah.
day. And it was really a really tough decision, but I ended up choosing UNC. And that's kind of that's where my journey was there. Did I answer your question?
You did. Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Well, I hear great things about the research triangle down there, so that's very cool too, to just be surrounded by a lot of academics and collaborations, I'm sure. Yeah, it's interesting because I asked this question to a lot of people, and there are some fields, and I witnessed some at Drexel where you just sort of apply to the program and then you do a rotation for different labs. And actually, one of my interviewees who's at Penn in neuroscience or something is doing that. He's in his third rotation now. And so for me, it was exactly like the same as you. It was like, I apply to the school, but in my cover letters, I'm like, I would want to talk to this professor, like, or I really like this professor's research. And I think there are pros and cons, So did you like hit the ground running with research then right away?
Pretty much. So with UNC, and I know this varies so much about like per program in terms of like what your milestones are. So for us, you have to do a first year project. So,
Oh,
which is
like a
interesting.
candidacy. It's like a candidacy or
Not really, because
like qualifiers.
you're not
No.
getting passed or failed on it at
Oh,
all.
it's
It's
just a thing. Okay.
like, here's your first year project, and the idea is that eventually could lead into your master's. So we have to get our master's along the way.
Yep.
So it's just a way to make sure you're like, as a first year student, just like getting your foot in the door with research.
Yeah.
I think it's like the idea of it. So during your first year, you do a first year project. It is fairly like you're not getting really graded on it, which is nice. So you get to work with your mentor closely and figure out what your interests are. And then after that, you propose your master's project. And that should be kind of one bigger experiment for us. And then you do your experiment, you propose or your de you defend your master's, and then you get your master's, and then you do your comprehensive exams after that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's a basically you get 3 months to do a literature review on a topic
Okay.
that your committee approves, and then after the 3 months is up, your committee reads it and says, okay, you are now a PhD candidate or not.
So it's just written, there's no presentation part.
Yeah, which is kind of nice.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I know that also
Kind of
really
nice.
varies
It
across
does
careers.
vary, it's some of these like, oh, that's nice, but also like that was the hardest presentation I did because it was like the most at stake. But I think that it's also a good experience for PhD students to do more presentations. So, you know, pros and cons.
Right. So we have to propose our dissertation, which is kind of our big, like,
presentation.
Yeah. And that's kind of the one where your committee will probably ask you, like, more difficult questions because you're proposing what your dissertation will be. So for us, the more proposal part can be a little bit more nerve-wracking. And I just did that a week ago and it went well, but it was still a little scary.
But now you're on the other side. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. So I want to back up. So did you have classes, I assume?
Yeah.
For how many years?
I did classes for 4 years. So you definitely have to take classes your first few years here. But you can get through it a bit quicker if you overload. If you like take more classes early on, you can maybe finish it up in like 3, but I finished in 4, which was really nice. Because I also got a statistics minor, so I had to take a lot more statistics classes. So I was taking a lot of classes.
Learning a lot, of course.
Yeah.
What about, this is a abrupt question, but what was funding your first year when you did that project?
The first year project?
Or just like, where is the funding coming from all the time, I guess is the big question.
Yeah, that's a tough question.
Yeah.
It really depends. For us, your first year, it just varies. Based on your lab too. So if your lab has a grant, you're going to be a research assistant on that grant usually, and that's how you're paid. But for us, we have the option to be a teaching assistant. So that's what I ended up doing. I believe that's so long ago, but I think that's what I ended up doing for my first year. And that's what I've been usually doing through graduate school, is doing some sort of TA position, or if my mentor does get a grant, I'll be a research assistant on that. But usually it's teaching assistantship here.
Interesting. Yeah, I only asked because the first year project sounds super cool and useful and like a good experience. But I wondered, you know, if you're working on that, is it related to the grant that you're on, or is it, or are you not working on the grant because you're working on that? You know, that's sort of where my question was headed.
Yeah.
I'm sure they figured it out, but I was just like, oh, that's cool. But like, wait a minute. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's something our program is trying to figure out a little bit more as well, just like what the first year project is really supposed to be doing, because some people will design a full new like experiment essentially, which is a lot of work, and again, it's great experience, but it can end up delaying you a little bit if you do a really big first year project that's, you're setting it up yourself and you're, you know, running all these participants. Where with my first year project, I had previously collected data to kind of analyze, so that worked out really nicely where it wasn't going to be such a big burden on me to, you know, make my own study and try to analyze, like do all that in just a year, because you're taking a lot of classes your first year too. It's kind of a shock to your system, and like no matter how much you prepare, it's like it's a lot to be a first year graduate student. So you know,
it's so much, and it's just like balancing classes with research is not something that you have to do in undergrad, you know. It's classes. So
that was a big shift for me, just realizing like, oh, like research is now more important than classes. That's really
weird,
hard.
Right?
it was really hard to get used to.
So tell me what your lab is like. How big is it? How big is your group?
Yeah, it's pretty small. We have two, so me and another graduate student, and then one more joining us. And we usually have like 5 to 6 research assistants. Okay. Right now we don't have any postdocs, but sometimes we'll have a postdoc or two. And then my mentor, Joe Hopfinger, kind of runs the whole thing. And depending on what you're doing too, my program is super collaborative, which is what something I really love about it. So I might be working with a different lab, but sometimes, like right now, I'm working with a lab that researches memory. So I'm working with a mentor, like a different mentor in my program that researches memory. And so I'm really lucky that I get to have her as like a side mentor too. So
Yeah.
it kind of, my specific lab is pretty small, but the UNC Psych and Neuroscience program is really big and very collaborative, which is super nice.
That's great. Okay, so now tell me about your research or what you proposed, or
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't
So
give me the whole
my
proposal. We don't have time for that. So,
no.
quick.
No. And I don't want to do that again. No offense, but yeah. So my lab and what Joe Hopfinger does is he is really interested in the neural mechanisms of attention. So how we're attending to certain things in our environment. Like how does that work? So what I'm going to be doing for my dissertation is I'm really interested in broadly how do we get distracted? And so what I'm going to be looking at is the neural mechanisms of how we get distracted, basically. So how do we suppress things that are irrelevant in our visual, like in our environment, but really pop out at us, like things that, are irrelevant but capture our attention? How do we actually suppress those things? Because we can do it. Like in our normal, you're not captured, like your attention isn't captured by every single red thing that pops up, right? So we do know how to suppress stuff and not get distracted by stuff, but how does that actually happen at a neural level? Yeah.
Wow, that's so cool. How do we do it? So then if you know how, we can improve,
Yeah,
presumably.
hopefully. Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, hopefully it'll tell us more about like getting less distracted by things that are really distracting. Like how quickly it happens. So EEG is really great at like timing. So its temporal precision is really wonderful and it can tell us how quickly things are happening. So is this a process that happens really quickly or really slowly? And like how can we implement that in at a broader level too? It's not something, so I'm not as translational right now. Like I'm really narrowly focused on the neural mechanisms of it, but a lot of people are really interested in attention because we have all these screens in front of us and people get distracted a lot. And so how is that working? Something I'm really interested in.
Especially with like remote work, it's
Yeah.
just like, wow, that's so fascinating. That's gonna be really cool. But here's what I'm thinking about. So if you're observing, like, how do you force, how do I ask this? Do you predict that there's a way to see from a neural activity standpoint if somebody is suppressing versus not suppressing that distraction?
Right. So something we can do is usually you'll put a bunch of things on the screen in front of a person, and then you have something really distracting on the screen. And what happens is there's a certain ERP, event-related potential component that kind of peaks if you are actually suppressing that distractor. And it's called the PD component. And it's been a really well-studied marker of suppression. So when we see that ERP component, it's a really good indicator that, okay, the person's actually suppressing this distracting thing that they are seeing in front of them.
No, okay, cool. That's exactly what I was wondering about. I was like, how do you know? Do you ask them? Like, hello, were you distracted by this? Like, I don't know if I could answer that.
We don't usually ask them, which maybe we should, but
that's so cool. And then obviously I'm just thinking about this. So then what if like if you're able to if you suppress everything, does that like cause fatigue? Right? Like, does your brain get tired because you're working harder to suppress distractions?
Yeah, that's actually, you nailed it right on the head. That's like a really big
Is
question that people are
that your
interested in.
thesis?
No. I think maybe eventually I might explore that, but that's a really big question is like, are there certain kinds of distractors that are more fatiguing, right? Or like, how long does it take to get fatigued? That's a really big question right now. And it's not one I have a great answer to. I'm sure it probably is really fatiguing. And it's also tough too, because with the experiments we do, and usually in cognitive psychology, you're in the lab as a participant doing the study for like an hour, so you are getting fatigued to some extent.
Just by design, you're getting fatigued, yeah.
Right. So yeah, it is kind of tricky to study that, because I think at least what you're getting at is, in the real world, how is fatigue happening? And so that is something that's really tough with what we do, is it is hard to like, you're not going to put an EEG cap on someone and like be like, go and like to the outside world.
Live
Like,
your life,
yeah.
yeah.
I mean, some people are doing that, and I'm sure that's going to be really cool research, but it's really hard to do right now.
Yeah.
And like
Yeah,
look
you
at,
need like
but
a
yeah.
portable EEG. That's
Yeah.
so cool.
Which people are working on. But it's
Yeah.
not, at least with the kind of EEG system I use, you're plugged into a lot of
Yeah.
stuff and need to be in a electrically shielded booth so we don't get noise from other
Yeah.
places. So,
Interesting. Very
yeah.
cool. Well, I will be staying tuned to learn about your research so
Yeah.
that I could be more productive in my day job. Very cool. Well, I want to jump to my like three wrap-up questions, but before I do that, what are some things you do outside of your PhD to have fun or de-stress or enjoy life? I hope you do something.
I do. And that was something I had to learn, though, and I had to figure out was what are the things, because you can't do work all the time, or at least it's really hard. But generally, I really like being outdoors. I played lacrosse at Haverford, and so I was really lucky that there is a club team here that I can play on. It's a lot of people my age that still want to play, and we actually end up playing a lot of club college teams around here. So we'll play Duke and UNC and NC State, and
Oh,
it's
that's funny.
really
I thought you meant
super
that you were on
fun.
the UNC club lacrosse team. No, this is like
No.
private club. Yeah.
Yeah. But my very fun update is I actually joined the UNC club team handball team like 2 months ago.
Oh my God,
So
that's
I'm now
awesome.
playing team handball with UNC. So that's been really, really fun. I've never heard of it really beforehand. And so I joined the team 3 weeks before nationals. So I'd only played six times before we went to nationals, and we got second place, which is really exciting. And
Pretty good.
not bad. Right, that's been really fun. It's been great to get back into a team environment. I've been really missing that. Like, I needed a break after college. I did lacrosse and field hockey my whole life. And so after college, I was like, you know what? I do kind of need a little break. But now I'm just like, I really miss the team sports. I miss having practice. So it's just something to take my mind off of school and work. So yeah, I do my team sports still. I do my bar three classes, which is why my hair is wet. I just came from a bar three workout class, which is like a high intensity workout class.
Yeah.
And I play pickleball, which is all the rage right now. And
Ah, love
I
pickleball.
know
Love
it's
that.
so fun. And we play like my cognitive psychology grad students will play together, which is fun.
That's amazing. That's great.
Yeah.
What a good sport for that too. What like a good like just like fun sport to play with people that you work with.
Yeah, it's really fun. But yeah, so I do a lot of sports, which I just love that. And I'll go to trivia once every week too, just to
Oh,
do some
a
fun.
classic.
Yeah.
Classic grad student evening activity.
Yep.
But it's so important. Like obviously you said you had to learn this, but like one, like staying active, I think it's just good for your mind health, to do. If you're not playing sports, then you're, running or biking or, something active. But then also just like taking yourself out of the lab and like away from your computer and thinking about something else is also so important.
Yeah, and
But
it's really,
hard.
it's hard, and it's really important to have your grad school community. Like, that's something I also love about UNC. The grad students here have been so great and supportive. But I also think it's nice to get a group of friends that aren't necessarily doing grad school so that you can have other people to talk to and just be like, okay, we're not going to complain about like what we're doing, like get really, focused on our research when we're hanging out, which it naturally happens because you all kind of do similar stuff and you're all having similar stressors. But it is nice to just, get with my lacrosse team or a handball team even and just like have conversations that aren't about research.
Like your life,
Yeah, like life stuff.
let them complain about their 9 to 5, right? And you're like,
Yeah.
oh,
Yeah.
I kind of don't want that, you know?
Yeah, right.
Well, very cool. I'm happy to hear all the fun things you're doing, and I feel like I need to play handball now.
You should try. Everyone should try. It's gonna be the next big thing, I'm telling you. And it's in the Olympics. So if you want to go to the Olympics, it might be an option for you.
I played rec handball in Philly, but it was co-ed, and the men just like ripped it at you, and it was painful. So maybe I will pursue not that.
Yeah, I know Philly does have a women's team handball. We
They
did play
do.
them.
Oh, really? But
Yeah.
they do, because I started to play frisbee when I moved to Philly, and one of the girls on the I was playing with, she was like, someone just contacted me about like trying out for the handball team. I've never played before. And I was like, you should do it. Like,
Yeah.
do it. So
Yeah, that's basically what happened to me. So, someone
very
was
cool.
like, do you want to just play handball? And I
We need
was like, okay.
athletes.
I know,
Are you an
exactly.
athlete?
It was someone from my high school that I ran into very randomly at my workout class. And I was just like, okay,
Whoa.
like it's been a while. And then they texted me like 2 hours later and were like, hey, we need
That's
people on the
crazy.
handball team. Like, I know you're athletic and could figure it out. Do you want to play? And I was like, sure. And so I wiki-howed it before practice. Had no idea what I
Yeah.
was doing.
That's how I got into frisbee. I ran into, do you remember Stuart Heen from Haverford? He was
Vaguely.
on the frisbee team. Anyway, he was maybe a year older than you, but I ran into him in the grocery store in West Philly, and he was like, "Hey, what's up? Like, we need a third like frisbee player who's never played before." And I was like, "Could be fun, you know?" So, very cool. I love
Yeah.
that. Always say yes, right?
Yeah, that's kind of my philosophy. Sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Yeah,
Say
yeah,
no
yeah. Depend.
sometimes.
Say no sometimes. Good, good, good. All right, very cool. Is there anything else you want to talk about before I ask you these last questions? No?
Think so.
Cool. We've
I've covered a
covered
lot.
the whole gambit. All right, so my first question is, looking back on your time so far, what was something challenging that you faced in your program?
Yeah, for sure. So, at the risk of sounding redundant with possibly other people who have come on this podcast, I think COVID was a big.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even talk about that.
Okay, yeah, that was a big challenge that I had faced, and a lot of other people in my program had faced. So, I was in my third year, I believe, when the shutdown happened, and I was about to propose my master's project. So I proposed it on Zoom, but the issue is I work with human participants that are college kids. So there was a very solid year of time when college kids weren't really back on campuses. I was having a really hard time and
So you
ID
weren't
stuff.
collecting any data.
No, it was really hard to collect data, like for my master's. So we had switched to doing some online stuff just in the meantime, but I got really delayed with my master's because like I had proposed a project where I was touching people's faces.
And then you could not.
And I cannot, and there's just like not a lot of people on campus for a while. So That was tough. And then just obviously, like, you don't didn't have the typical social connections that I was used to being at home. And, you know, it was, yeah, that was really hard. But I also was lucky that I was in my third year, so I did already have some social connections. Like, I'd built that beforehand. And I know for the people that were first years starting with COVID, they were having an even harder time because they were taking all their classes online. They weren't having that typical social community that we usually have at UNC. So I think that was my biggest challenge, and hopefully something that other people don't have to face in the future. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, agreed. And I think you're right. I think it was way harder for the people who started during COVID or even like graduated during COVID and started a new job. But I also think, like you said, like certain projects can really be done remotely. You know, there's a lot of I know a lot of people who wrote a bunch of papers or did a lot of like modeling and like you know they learned new skills and but you know for something you just proposed where you have to like work face to face with humans, you know it's not as easy. So did you so post COVID or whatever we're in right now, what did you do you go into the lab every day or are there things you can do remotely?
Yeah, so I still do a lot of things like research activities at home. I do a lot of my writing at home. I've just gotten so used to writing on my own
Without
computer.
distractions,
Yeah,
perhaps.
no distractions. For sure. Because I mean, when I'm in the lab, it's really lovely, but you know, you do end up chatting a lot with your people in your lab, and so sometimes it can be a little distracting to be in lab, but I am in lab quite frequently because I am doing human research where I have to put an EEG cap on someone's head and like collect data. Or even just I mentor a lot of undergraduate RAs, so I do try to go in to meet face to
Work with
face with
them.
them and like explain like certain things that to keep the lab running and the different projects we do running.
And you said that you want to be a professor, so it sounds like mentoring students is a good, well, A, it sounds like you enjoy that, but also that that's a good thing to practice if you want to be doing that for your career, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I've been a lacrosse coach for a long time, and I love coaching, and I think there's a lot of overlap with coaching and mentoring. I really love working with people one-on-one and really seeing them do great things, and I just like get so proud of them, and I do really love that part of science.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, I took on some tangents there. Next question. What advice would you give to yourself back in year one?
That's a really good question. I think understanding like what works for me. So going through this process, you learn more about what works for you as a PhD student. It's, at least for me and my program, it's a really independent process. So you are setting like your milestones are kind of dependent on you and just you. Like you're If you want to propose your master's, it's more reliant on you to like get that done. Like there's not like any sort of set timelines necessarily for that. So I think for this is very probably really specific advice for me, but I figured out that I do really thrive on deadlines. So being able to set maybe asking my mentor to set some more deadlines, specific deadlines for me, and like he would be okay if like I missed it by, but it just having that would have been really helpful. And I think just feeling confident to reach out to other mentors earlier, just to have my like professors in my field, just to have more deeper, like more social connections too, just having different people I can reach out to that are other professors in my program. just to talk about like, hey, what was your academic journey like? Or just like having other people's perspective earlier would have been nice. Not that like my mentor's been really great with that, but it's, you know, he's just one person. So I think it would have been really nice to reach out to other folks a little bit earlier too and just see what they're doing.
Probably too, as you sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, the more of those connections you make along the way, the more informed you feel when you're making those decisions later.
Right. And they want to help you too.
They do.
So.
And they love talking about their work. So if that's what you want to do, talk about their work. Professors, we all love you. It's okay.
We do.
Okay, very good. Good advice. All right, so last question is, can you share a good memory so far of your time as a PhD student? Perhaps a story or a fun trip or something?
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing I thought of was we would have something called First Fridays on the front porch at UNC. I'm not sure if they still do it. This was pre-shutdown COVID times. But so First Fridays of each month, there'd be live music at the Carolina Inn near us, which is just like a place on campus, basically. So we would go after our statistics class to listen to live music together as first years, and that was really lovely because usually, so with our statistics class, everyone has to take it. So that includes like clinical psychology, behavioral integrative neuroscience, social psychology, developmental psychology, like all those first year students are taking stat statistics together. So it's a really nice bonding opportunity with people that you're not probably not going to see as much as you go through your PhD. So that was really lovely. That's how I got to meet a lot of my really dear friends who are doing clinical psychology. Like they invited me one time after statistics class and were just like, "Hey, we're going to listen to live music. Do you want to come and just eat food and chat?" And like that's kind of where I would develop a lot of really close bonds with the graduate students in my program, and we're still super close, like even 5 years later. So that's kind of
That's
something I
great.
thought of. Yeah.
Love that. It's so funny. I ask a lot of people this question, obviously, and sometimes people are like, "Oh, like I went to a conference in Hawaii, you know, cool." But a lot of times people are like, "You know, I just have like good memories that I can't really pinpoint that are just like of us hanging out like late at night or after like a tough day in the lab, you know, going to get a beer." And I think looking back on it, and it's nice that you're able to look back on it while you're still in it. But looking back on it, you know, there are those nice memories that come in between some of the challenges that also exist.
Definitely.
Well, that's all my questions. Hannah, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story. I also want to ask you if there's anything you want to plug, any research papers coming out, any book chapters. It's okay if the answer is no.
No, nothing specific, but I mean, you know, I will hopefully be, I'm just going to be starting my dissertation project. So if it's something that anyone's interested in, I will hopefully be publishing that within a year or so. So if you're at all interested in distraction or neural mechanisms of distraction, look out for that. And yeah, I'm just also generally happy to talk with people about, you know, graduate school, if you like your journey is at all similar to mine or your interest in psychology and neuroscience. Like something I love to do is help people through the process of like how to apply and how to like write a cover letter or like know what a CV is or looking at programs. So if that's something you're interested in too, I'm like so happy to chat about that. Because it's hard to know too. I was like,
It's so hard.
there's so many things that are unspoken that you should know how to do, and you know, we need to disseminate that knowledge as well and like help everybody get into grad school that wants to. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
for sure. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was very enjoyable.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. I had a really great time.
Thanks to Hannah for coming on the show. If you or someone you know wants to be interviewed on Impact Factor, feel free to reach out via Instagram and follow us for updates at Impact Factor Pod. Thank you all for listening and have a great week.